Welcome to the Teacher As podcast. I'm your host, Melissa Milner, a teacher who is painfully curious and very easily inspired. This podcast is ever-changing, and I hope with each season, you find episodes that speak to you in your work as an educator. This is the fifth season of The Teacher As, and it's exciting to see the growth in how many educators are listening. Episodes are released every other week. If you enjoy The Teacher As, please rate it on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. It helps the podcast reach more educators. Thanks for listening.
My name's Jen Hawkins, and I'm here with Melissa today to talk about student vital actions. I've worked with Melissa before in a previous podcast about teacher moves, and then sort of the partner to that is, what are the student vital actions? What are the teachers moving the kids towards? I'm an independent consultant, and I also work with Flynn Education and the math leadership program at Mount Holyoke College. And I work with illustrative mathematics as well.
Yes, you do. That's how I met you with a PD from my district. So we're talking, when you're talking student vital actions, you're talking specifically about in the math classroom.
Yep. Although much of this is applicable in any class, I mean, because it's about students being engaged and thinkers, and that's vitally important because, you know, the word vital means to be full of energy, and we want our students to be engaged and full of energy. And the word vital means essential and absolutely necessary. And if students are not engaged thinkers in our classroom, then we are failing.
Absolutely. Let's get started. Do you have like a list of them, or how did we do this?
Well, I do have a list, but it's not my list. I'm the thinking behind this that I'm absorbing and using and building on is from a partnership called the Strategic Education Research Partnership, which is abbreviated as SERP, S-E-R-P. SERP was started by, I believe it was Phil Darrow. He was one of the writers of the Common Core. And it was a research partnership to create new tools for schools, and it's particularly connected to mathematics. And so through my work with illustrative mathematics, I found a link to the ideas that the SERP Institute has put forward about student vital actions, and there are seven of them. And
let's talk about it. Is it ranked, or they're all equally as important, I'm assuming?
I think they're all equally as important. I will tell you my favorites, but there are seven of them. The first one is about having all students participate. The second is about students saying a second sentence. The third is about students being able to talk about one another's thinking. The fourth one is about students being able to revise their thinking. The fifth and sixth vital actions are about students using precise mathematical language and about ELL students using whatever language they can to convey their ideas and giving them a support in moving towards academic language. And then the seventh and my favorite student vital action is about perseverance and productive struggle. But I do have a few favorites, but number seven is my favorite.
I think we'll end with that one.
Okay, sure. That sounds
good. So maybe just start with number one and tell us just a little bit more about it, what it looks like in the classroom.
Sure. So what's interesting about this is that you notice how they were all about what students are doing. So this is about looking at students. And what's interesting about the student vital actions is that if an administrator walked into a classroom, an administrator could be looking at what the students are doing and not what the teachers are doing and find out if the students are being positioned as thinkers in the classroom. And so most of these things are observable things that can help administrators and fellow teachers that may be observing a peer, you know, provide feedback about whether the students are positioned as capable thinkers. So, you know, all students participate, you know, like if we walk into a classroom and we see one student just continually raising their hand and answering all the questions, what does that tell us about the rest of the kids in the classroom? How are they feeling when they see that one kid always with their hand up? A lot of the times they may feel like they are not making valuable contributions to the class. And then there can kind of be a downward spiral where they start to think, well, maybe I don't have valuable contributions, or maybe my ideas aren't any good. So it's really an equity issue, because the people that are talking in class are learning the most in class. And so if only a few students talk, and if a teacher doesn't have strategies and moves that provide opportunities for everybody to participate, then the learning opportunities are not equivalent, and the quiet students may lose confidence. So you know, you want to walk into a room and see a classroom where all students participate. And if you're a teacher, you want to ask yourself as a reflection after a class, who did I call on? How often did I call on so-and-so? Whose ideas were brought forward? Was there any sort of perhaps unintended bias in who I gave attention to and whose voices seemed important? And so teachers want to be cognizant of that.
Yes. And in the episode that we did together about teacher moves, you talk about that in depth. And I'm going to link that episode in this episode page so people can, you know, listen to this and then go listen to the teacher moves one, because they are very much intertwined.
Very much hand in hand. Oh, thanks, Melissa. That's great. Well, what I can also mention is that in the last podcast, and I'm sure with this one, we'll link the resources that the SERP Institute provides. And they provide with every single one of these student vital actions a list of six or seven different specific teacher moves to help you get these things to happen in your classroom more. So it's something that I love to work with teachers about. And, you know, in fact, next Friday, I'll be working with a school in Western Mass about this topic.
It's important.
Yeah. So I'll talk about the second one. And it's one that I kind of misunderstood for a while, but it's about getting students to say a second sentence. And so my initial thinking about this was about, oh, well, we want kids to always say more than just an answer. We want them to say, the answer is 12, because I know that I'm going to be using subtraction for this problem and, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. But, you know, I thought it was always about, we want students to say some more because an answer is not enough. But it's also about getting students to provide an answer with explanation that will make sense to their classmates. And so you have a community that is learning together when students have to not necessarily defend, but elaborate on their thinking so that their classmates can understand it.
And learn.
Right. And so the student who has to arrange their thinking in a way that's understandable to other people is processing and thinking more deeply. And the other students are learning from it as well as the teacher. Right. And so we want students to say more than 12. We want them to say why, how,
yeah,
et cetera.
Do we want to get to the point where we're not having to prompt for that say more?
Sure.
Explain. Like, eventually we hope that it just becomes a routine for them and they know to do it.
Right. But at first you might have to have, you know, some sort of teacher moves that are the things you say to get them to say something else. Like, I don't know, why do you think that is? Or do you think that's always true? Those kinds of things. But you want to be able to ask a student to say more. Or I can imagine that if I was in the classroom full time, I might put up a peace sign, which is like two fingers, and that might just be like a signal to the kids, okay, you're going to say a little bit more, you know, you've given me one great thing, and I put up a second finger saying, now give me something else with it. And maybe that might be a silent signal to help kids know, got to say a little bit more in my class.
I like the nonverbal, like you're just with the fingers up. That's awesome.
Yeah. And we're all willing to put up a peace sign. Peace sign's a good message.
Absolutely. I think this was discussed in that other episode. And I remember when we were doing the math lab, and I think I had to teach the part where it's that warm up and they're all doing the
thumbs up to their chest. Yeah.
Like silent thumbs up.
Yeah.
And so one student answered, and then I said, oh, can you tell me how you figured that out? And they started to tell it. And then while they're telling it, they realized they got it wrong.
Ah.
And they like, in that telling, they were able to backtrack and go, actually, it's this because da-da-da-da. And all the right. students were like, yes, that's what it was.
Yes.
It was like a great moment. It was so
it
cool.
It was. And so you had a great teacher move that prompted that moment. And we see how by a student having to talk about their thinking, they might just realize that there was a change they wanted to make. And you'll just jump us right now to number four, and then we'll come back to number three. Because number four is about revising your thinking and seeing students revise their thinking. And so when students are learning from their mistakes, and when others are learning from the community that might make mistakes and know that they get supported in that community, that's super.
Yeah, that whole growth mindset too.
Mm-hmm. It makes students analytical, makes them critical thinkers and deeper thinkers as well. So you want to be revealing, you want to be willing to revise your thinking, either make it better or change it entirely if you realize it's wrong.
Sometimes we have a parking lot where the kids put post-its up, you know, what did I learn? I'm wondering, maybe there should be a revision parking lot when you change your thinking about something in math class, do a post-it. Oh, I thought it was this, but then I realized it was that. Like, I just came up with that. Because then that's, you know, they might have done it when they were working with a partner, and I might not even know that they've done this wonderful revision of their thinking. But if they share it on a post-it, then I'll, you know, I will know and everybody else can see it.
Right. And anytime a teacher recognizes things with some kind of a display in the classroom, kids respond to it. Absolutely.
Definitely. All right. So now back to three.
Number three. Number three was being able to talk about each other's thinking. So when students are able to talk about each other's thinking, it means that they're listening to each other. It means that they are processing what students say. And it develops their proficiency in reasoning as well, when they can consider what someone else is saying and make sense of it.
So what does that look like in the classroom? Is it when they turn and talk and then this student has to retell what their partner?
It could be that, or it could be, you know, if a student is starting to explain something and then is sort of drifting because they can't finish, you know, sometimes they say, can anybody pick this up and take it all the way through? And that promotes listening. For when are you going to pick up that loose ball and carry it over the end line? So you want to be able to talk about each other's thinking and be able to critique it and elaborate on it as appropriate.
I also find my kids, when we do the warm up every day, I hear students saying, my idea is sort of like blah blahs, but I just did it this way instead, you know. But they're paying attention and they're saying, you know, mine's like hers or mine's like what they did, but I just did it this way, you know.
Yeah. So they're making connections. They're building patterns in their mind, and patterns are what lead to great mathematical conclusions.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Patterns are so important.
They are. And so five and six, I do usually consider together because they're both about language, but one is about academic language and one is about ELL students being able to express their ideas in the way that is comfortable for them. And you'll see teacher moves here around sentence starters or around, you know, collecting the words that students are using, you know, like say like in second or third grade, when we talk about where two edges of a shape meet, you know, we can call that a vertex, but we could call it a point, or we could call it a dot. And so you want to let kids call it what they want to call it, but we also want to use the math language in context appropriately so that kids can be sort of on a continuum of moving from the words that they're familiar with toward that math word. Like if we insist that they must say vertex, I mean, that's not necessarily very natural for an 8 or 9 year old at all. If they say, oh, that dot in the corner, and I go, oh yeah, this right here, and I point to it, and I go, oh, I call that a vertex. You know, that way they start to see the word in context. And one thing that has changed in math education is that research shows that introducing vocabulary in isolation is not the best way to turn kids onto math words. And, you know, you want to have context around it the whole time.
So you just spoke a lot about teacher moves related to this. What does it look like when the students are doing this in the classroom?
Remember how earlier I talked about how an observer could come into a room and could see what's happening and know if students are positioned as mathematical thinkers. And so if we're in a room and we hear kids, you know, using precise language, if we hear kids helping each other with words that are mathematically precise, or we see a word wall that has been growing as a unit has moved on, when we see a teacher accept language that perhaps is not mathematically precise, but is clear in its meaning from an ELL student, then these are things that we see in the classroom that tell us that language is being embraced appropriately.
And I mean, a word wall, you know, sometimes I just, for the whatever we're doing that day, I put it up. I have to find room, and we don't have a lot of wall space, unfortunately, but I have to find a way to be able to display words for the unit, not just what we're working on that. Like, I got to get better at that and find a spot for that.
I mean, that is a teacher's struggle. And also, I encourage teachers to sit in the back of the room and make sure you can read them from there, because sometimes they're not big enough to read from the back of the room. And if kids are working groups all around the carpet perimeter, they might be like, oh, what's that word? Oh, I can't even see it. And they might not get up and go look at it. So I really suggest they be big and bold.
Yeah, I got to figure that out.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, another thing on my list that I need to make sure I'm doing better.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what's fun about teaching, is that it's always a challenge and it's interesting and we're always learning.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that was 5 and 6, right?
Yes. Oh, so now we get to number 7, which is
number
my favorite.
Number 7, the favorite.
Yes, yes. Lucky number 7. You see students persevering through difficulty. And this is something I've been thinking about so much the last couple of years. Things I've collected are like some of the sayings about how showing what you already know is not learning.
Yep.
And we talked about that last time because I was really nervous to do the podcast. And I was like, well, I'm learning something. It's not easy. And if it's new, it's supposed to be hard.
Yeah.
So we want to be modeling perseverance. We want to see kids not giving up when they get to the hard stuff. We want to see teachers say statements or provide guidance or ask questions that make kids think harder and not give up. Because when kids push through, they feel so confident when they succeed and they're rewarded and they want to do more. And so as much as we care about our students, we can't coddle them. We have to let them wrestle with stuff. And if you're doing 3 or 4 examples of anything before they ever work on their own, then they don't have the perseverance to do anything on their own. And so I think that in general, the whole student vital actions, you know, thing is about creating kids that can think, that are capable, and that are not passive.
Absolutely. And again, we talked about this in the last episode, how hard it is when you know you've got 5 or 6 kids that aren't going to know what to do. And just to send them off, knowing that they are going to fail.
Have a difficult. Well, no, we don't know they're going to fail. Nope. We don't want to think that. We can say they're going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
They're going to have a hard time. But if you use some intentional partnering, and if you've created a community where they know it's okay to try stuff,
yep,
and it's okay to make mistakes, even when kids solve a problem and it's wrong, there is something that they've done that's right.
That's yes. I do a lot. I'll do my favorite mistake.
Yeah.
Where I'll pull that up. But I also think just walking around at the beginning of the year, it was different. But now I'm like, go.
Well, so yeah, you see that now they're getting used to it because, you know, you've changed in your school into a problem-based curriculum where kids are presented with something that's hard. But even if you have them just go, as you said, and if they go in different directions with their partner and say only one partnership succeeds and the others don't, you can still pull things from the ones that don't get to the finish line and use them in your synthesis of the lesson, and they can feel good about how far they got. And then sometimes as they're hearing themselves explain, they might say, oh, wait a second.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. And that happens. And then we just get so excited about it that they feel positive and encouraged and want to try again the next time.
It's so true. And it's very hard to just, you want to like coddle them. I mean, in a way, you know, but no, I mean, you have to, they're not going to learn if you're doing everything step by step with them.
Right. And so like, this is probably, I think my 3rd year just going into schools that I've never been into before, teaching lessons I may or may not have taught before. And I'm talking about grades K through 12 at this point, and having teachers say, before we do the lesson, they can't do it. And having me say, we're going to try. And I don't think it's just luck that every single time there has always been at least one student who had the thing. And we don't just call on that student because they have the thing, but we intentionally pair that student with other students so that they learn from each other, or we have that student share a piece of their thinking and then we have others build on it. But whatever it is, I've never seen a problem-based learning lesson fail. I mean, I'll knock on wood, I'm doing one tomorrow in a grade in a school I've never been to. Maybe tomorrow's going to be the fail, but I don't think so. Kids really come through.
Yeah, but in saying that, you are talking about the power of the synthesis. That's what you're really talking about.
Yes, but also the faith that we need to have in our students.
Of course.
That they can do it and that they don't need me to tell them. But with the right guidance and with, you know, strong curricula that give us the resources to give kids the experiences where they do think, amazing things can happen.
What I love with illustrative math, as far as student moves, is that the warm-ups in particular are very,
High ceiling, low floor.
So any student, like notice and wonder, well, they can notice and wonder whatever they notice and wonder. It doesn't have to be, and just that alone helps with participation right at the beginning of the lesson.
Right. And when you feel good at the beginning of the lesson, you're encouraged to continue and persevere through the whole thing.
So I love that. And with the vital actions, I think teacher moves and the vital actions, you know, in order to get those vital actions, the teacher moves have to be in place. So if you're listening to this, really make sure you go listen to the teacher moves so that you can get your students to be doing these vital actions.
Right. And check out, you know, all you have to do is, you know, Google SERP Institute, but we will provide links with this recording.
And what does SERP stand for?
It stands for Strategic Education Research Partnership.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. So great resources there. Great resources for administrators and for teachers as well.
Is there anything else you want to say about vital actions before I ask you the last question?
When I'm often going into the classrooms is I have no preconceived notions about any of the kids. I am monitoring as I walk around. I'm listening to their turn and talks. I'm looking at their papers. And I am just, you know, pulling what I think is the best stuff to use when we wrap up. And I can't tell you how many times after that lesson where I taught without any preconceived notions, teachers will say, wow, I never knew so-and-so could do blah, blah, blah. Or I was surprised. Or somebody would say, do you know who just was amazing in class that has never said anything? And because I don't have any preconceived notions, things happen differently. And so that really tells us a lot.
I think SERP should add that as a teacher move. Start every math lesson with a blank slate on all kids.
I wish we could do that. It would. And we have to stop referring to kids as high and low because those are preconceived notions.
It's so true. It's like kind of a whole paradigm shift.
Yeah, it's not helpful.
The last question is, what are you professionally zooming in on right now?
Zooming in.
Oh, the zoom in moment. I guess one of the things that I'm thinking about is an idea from Building Thinking Classrooms, which is another cool thing that you might have gotten into before, Melissa.
Yeah, Annalise Record talks about it a lot.
And it's about how students ask us proximity questions just because we're walking by. And they ask us questions as soon as things get hard because they want us to think for them. And so I really like this idea that I got from Building Thinking Classrooms about how when they ask us those questions that are not going to help their brains grow whatsoever, that I have a list and it's a teacher actually laminated it for me of what to say and then smile and walk away. And so, but you want to prep kids, especially the younger kids, to say there's certain kinds of questions that I'm not going to answer. And sometimes when you ask me a question that means that you want to stop struggling, I'm going to be saying one of these things to you and I'm going to smile and walk away. And it's not because I'm being tough on you. It's because I care about you. And I know that you can keep thinking and get there.
Yes. Can you send that to me so I can put it on the
Absolutely.
Episode page?
And I'll just give you a couple examples. One just might be saying, are you sure? And then walking away. Or if they said the answer is 7, I know it is. Then you could just say, are you sure? And walk away. Or they could say it's impossible. This can't ever work. Are you sure? And then walk away. And then you could also say something very simple like, why do you think that is? Or does that make sense? And then smile and walk away. But not easily done. But you just want to make sure you create the culture first, that the kids know why you're doing it. And that's what's so important at the beginning of the year is to build a culture about your expectations around language, around perseverance, and maybe discouraging hand raising and just going to quiet signals, stuff like that.
Fantastic. You're always amazing. I wonder whether we should do another episode just about math lab and what math lab
well,
is.
Well, we could do that sometime. Sure.
I'll give you a rest, though.
Thanks, Melissa. You're so fun to work with.
Thank you so much.
For my blog, transcripts of this episode, and links to any resources mentioned, visit my website at www.theteacheraz.com. You can reach me on Twitter and Instagram at Melissa B. Milner. And I hope you check out the Teacher As Facebook page for episode updates. Thanks for listening. And that's a wrap.